Hi, I'm Lily.
And I'm Carmen.
And welcome to
The Murder Show. Woohoo!
Today, I, Lily, am going to be doing a story on a woman named Joanna Yeats. I'll just get right into it. This is a pretty sad story.
Perfect.
It just shows you that you always have to be careful, but it also kind of can show you like what a trial by media is and how it can be very devastating for people that were innocent, maybe. That gives away the thing. I can't say that. Okay, I'm going to start over.
No, it doesn't give it away at all. I'm intrigued now.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I'm always intrigued, but...
Okay, so I think it's Joanna. That's how I'm going to say it. Joanna Claire Yeats, who often went by Jo, was born on April 19th, 1985, to David and Teresa Yeats in Hampshire, England. She had an older brother, Chris, who was 3 years her senior. She had a loving family, attended private schools, and later graduated from Riddle College with a degree in landscape architecture. She went on to get her postgraduate diploma in landscape architecture from the University of Gloucestershire. I don't know if that's right.
The English names, there's just no way.
Yeah.
There's just
no way. So, sorry, but... And for people who didn't know, postgraduate diploma is like a master's degree in the U.S. Like, similar thing.
Okay.
She was described as such like a bubbly, happy, like loved life. She was a perfect beacon of light. And that's a direct quote from someone in her family. So just a very like happy, happy person.
Right. Creative, I'm sure, as well.
Yeah, to be a landscape architect. Landscape
architecture. Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah. So in December 2008, Jo, I'm going to call her Jo from here on out. Jo met her boyfriend, then 25-year-old architect Greg Reardon. They worked together at an architecture firm in Winchester, and by all accounts, everything was going really, really well for the couple. They moved in together after a year of dating in 2009 when their architecture firm moved its headquarters to Bristol. So they left Winchester, moved to Bristol together, moved in together in 2009. And in October...
That was after how long of dating?
Only a year.
Oh, okay, well...
I know, and like for some people that's normal, and if that works for you, that works for you. If you found your right person,
sure.
I don't think I would do that personally, but you know,
I wouldn't either.
Everyone's different, and everyone does things at their own pace. At least it's not like 3 weeks. That would be like red flag.
Right.
So, and I guess because they didn't know people in Bristol really. I don't know. I'm not sure, but maybe if you don't really know people and you guys are both moving for work, it just kind of makes sense to live together. Yeah,
definitely. More, it can be definitely more economical.
Yeah.
And that's your person to give you company. It makes sense to a certain extent.
Yeah. So So when they moved to Bristol, they moved there in 2009. And then in October 2010, they moved to a suburb of Bristol known as Clifton. So from now on, when I say Bristol or Clifton, it's kind of similar. Like, it's just a suburb of Bristol, Clifton.
Okay.
So I might use them interchangeably. So.
Okay.
Between when they moved to Bristol and into the suburbs, Jo had actually left her job where she worked with Greg and got a new job. So they were no longer working together, but they both wanted to stay in Bristol, so they moved to Clifton. Their new place was actually an apartment in a large house. So it used to be a house that got turned into smaller apartments. This was around Christmas time. It's 2010 now. It's December 2010. And this was going to be the first Christmas that Jo and Greg actually spent together. They had the whole apartment decorated for Christmas. They had plans to throw a big Christmas party for their friends, actually. And Greg was actually going to spend the holidays with Jo's family for the first time. So they were going to drive up together and spend Christmas together.
Okay.
Which is a huge deal.
Worcestershire.
So they're they're from her family's from Hampshire, so they were going to spend Christmas in Hampshire, but they're in Bristol. Bristol's in the south. It's like southeast of London, or maybe just like directly east of London. But So, but basically everything looks like it's going perfect. They're going to have a Christmas party. He's going to spend the first Christmas with her family. Like, they are in love and they're moving.
Right.
They're moving their relationship forward and everything looks perfect. So because Greg was going to spend the Christmas holiday with Joe and her family, he still had to see his family. So the weekend before Christmas, he left to York, which is three and a half hours from where they lived.
You know, I've actually been there.
Oh, really?
And it is... Have you... Didn't you go as well?
To Yorkshire? I don't think so.
You didn't. Well, it is one of my favorite places in England, actually. It's so old. It's very medieval. It has this wall all around it that my mom made me touch a million times just because it's so old. But it's gorgeous. It's
oh, great. Really?
So that's so I picture cool. it in my mind.
I bet there's cool haunting stuff too there.
I'm sure they do have what's really kitschy and but typical of many of the cities in England is that they have that kind of like museum of terror or torture
thing. Oh, yeah. I didn't see that.
York has one. I'm pretty sure.
Okay, cool. Okay, so this weekend that – I don't know why Joe didn't just go with Greg to see – I think he was going to see his half-brother. I don't know why she didn't go, but she didn't go. And it was going to be the first weekend the couple would spend apart since they moved to Bristol over a year earlier.
Oh, wow.
That is – yes, that's what I read. That's what one of my sources said. So they hadn't really spent – and this was like a known thing because – she had talked about with her coworkers she was going to be lonely this weekend because Greg would be gone. So
sure.
At approximately 8 p.m. on December 19th, 2010, Greg returned from Yorkshire visiting his brother, his half-brother, to their flat in Clifton, and there was no trace of Joe. While he was in Yorkshire, he had called her and texted her multiple times but got no response. So he left for Yorkshire on December 17th, a Friday.
Okay.
He came back Sunday. But the whole weekend, she didn't respond to him. She didn't call him back. She didn't answer any of her phone calls. That's fucking weird. I would be freaking out if my partner did that to me.
I mean, this is 2010 by this point.
Everyone had phones, even if it wasn't an iPhone. Like, you had some sort of phone.
Right.
So
I would assume they would still even have the landline, too. So they would probably have both.
So apparently that didn't raise any red flags. I mean, I would hope that if that was me, my partner would contact someone to check on me or call, text someone, and be like, hey, is Lily okay? But that didn't happen. So I digress. When Greg got back to the flat at around 8 p.m. on December 19th, he was just like, oh, this is so weird. Where's Joe? He thought maybe she went out to grab something and she just wasn't at the apartment. Blah, blah, blah. But that's when he noticed his cat. They had a cat together, and the cat hadn't been taken care of. The litter box is really dirty. There was no food. And the cat was obviously in distress. And so he's kind of freaking out. So he calls her again. This is kind of like right when he gets home, and her phone starts ringing from her coat pocket that's hanging up by the door. Yeah. So... sorry, I flipped the wrong page. Okay, so he found that her purse and keys were also in the apartment. He gets there around, 8 p.m.? He gets there around 8 p.m., and by midnight, Greg had contacted the police and Joe's parents to report her missing. I don't know why he took 4 hours after getting home to do that, especially if all of her shit's there. She hasn't answered your phone call. I mean, those first 48 hours are so important.
It does feel like a little bit too long, even if he did kind of rationalize it to himself thinking she went to run an errand. 4 hours for an errand is still too long.
At 8 o'clock with no phone and no keys.
Like, what errands are you running right now?
This was also in the dead of winter. They were having a crazy freeze. Right. And her coat was hanging up. I think immediately – I mean, also, we are obsessed with true crime and listen to these stories constantly in our headphones. So we would think the worst. And I'm sure that not everyone has a fucked up brain like us to think that way. So benefit of the doubt. But if that ever happens to me, you better fucking call the police the second you don't hear from me.
The thing is that it's – also, everything compounded. It's the fact that she hasn't answered all weekend. It's the fact that it's this late at night. It's the fact that everything was left. So I mean, maybe if it was one of those things, he could rationalize it. But everything altogether, come on.
I'm just saying it's a little weird that he wasn't.
Yeah.
So
it's a little weird.
It was super out of character for Joe to just disappear. She wasn't that type of person. And she was super professional, like really good with her friends. She was always making plans with her friends, never missed anything. Like she was on her shit. She wasn't the kind of person that like me and you both cannot respond for a few days, you know, and like kind of disappear into the ether. But then we bounce back. Like Joe was not like that.
Right. Sure.
So luckily the police, like this might be one of the only stories we ever do where we say this, they did a really good job. And they worked really hard. And from the get-go, they thought something happened to Joe. So they believed her immediately when they said, this is not her. She doesn't just run away. And we know she's an adult, but she's missing. They started immediately that night at midnight when they got, the police were called. They started immediately investigating and tracking Joe's steps. I know. And this is like, I wish this could happen with every case. And I think it happened because Joe was affluent, white, beautiful, blonde haired, 25 years old.
I mean, we can't.
She was perfect for she was perfect for the media to jump onto. She was perfect for the police to take seriously. So I will say, like, she has so much, and that is a privilege to have the police take it seriously from the beginning. So
absolutely.
Greg left to see his family on Friday, December 17th, 2010. It was a 3-hour drive, which isn't all that bad for us as Americans. I don't know if that's considered like a big deal in other places where your country's not fucking huge, but
I kind of think so, especially in England where the distances are a lot shorter.
Yeah, so it was 3 hours. I don't know if that's considered long. If any English people ever listen to us, let us know. but that night after work, Joe went out to the Bristol Ramp Up. So this is December 17th. Greg is gone. Greg is like, bye, going to see my family. Joe made plans with coworkers to go out after work at a bar, the Bristol Ram Pub. She left around 8 p.m. It was a 20 or 30 minute walk back to her apartment, but she did stop at a few places along the way. We know this because even in 2010, England had a ton of CCTV footage, and they still do. They have a lot. So the CCTV footage caught her at three different places. First, she stopped at Waitrose Supermarket. She was only there for 10 minutes and she didn't buy anything. She was seen leaving the market on CCTV. And then we know she called her best friend, Rebecca Scott.
Is that not a little suspicious to be in a market for 10 minutes and,
not buy anything? I know, weird. So, like, it's just that that is weird. Like, maybe she was looking for something in particular. 2 minutes.
And it wasn't there. But 10 minutes is a long time to be in a little market.
Maybe she was looking for something and didn't find it. So then we know that she called her best friend Rebecca Scott at 8:30 to make plans for Christmas Eve. I think that might have been after. So she stopped at Bargain Booze where she bought. This is kind of like, I don't know the order everything happened in. I know the first market where she didn't buy anything was first. And then I also, but then the rest of these three things, I don't know what was first, second, or third. So she called her best friend, Rebecca Scott, to make plans on Christmas Eve for the party. And that was at 8:30. She stopped off at Bargain Booze, where she bought two ciders. And her final stop was at Tesco, which is like a supermarket. It's like a really popular supermarket in England. Around 8:40, where she bought a frozen pizza to eat for dinner.
Okay, so she probably just didn't like the selection.
Yeah, she probably just didn't find what she wanted. So we know she stopped at the Bargain Booze. She got two ciders, and then she went to two supermarkets. People, I mean, why did she get two ciders? I don't know. Maybe a woman can drink two ciders. Like, I don't think that personally says
that to me is not suspicious,
right? But I mean, it was picked up by the press that who is she meeting? Maybe she just want to get a little more tipsy. Cider has like 4% alcohol.
All I know about me is I always get two drinks if I'm going out.
Yeah, right. So
if I'm buying two drinks at the supermarket, I get two. So I don't think that's that weird.
Yeah, exactly. So detectives believe that – so Tesco was her last stop where she had the pizza. And in the CCTV footage, she has the pizza, she has the ciders, and that was around 8:40. Detectives believe that Joe made it home to her flat because the Tesco receipt for the pizza was found in her flat – along with the coat she was wearing in the CCTV footage.
Okay, wow.
The weird part is that the pizza box and its contents are nowhere to be found. They aren't in her freezer. Mm. They aren't in her fridge. They aren't in her oven. They're not in the trash can. The pizza box, the pizza, the plastic wrapping around the pizza, all of that is gone. So the police are like, where the fuck did the pizza go? And at this point, they're at a complete loss. It seemed like she just vanished into thin air because she definitely got home. Her Tesco receipt's there.
Right.
The ciders are there. Her coat is there. Her bag. Everything is there. Except her and the pizza. Just to recap, Joe was last seen on December 17th. Her boyfriend reported her missing on December 19th. The police are behind, and those first 48 hours are really important. But immediately, her family took to social media and press conferences to raise awareness about her disappearance. Facebook was around at this time, and it was big with younger people. Nowadays, I don't know if that, it would be Instagram, I would say, that you would use. But at this point, Facebook was like the shit to use when you're in college age post-grad. So her
absolutely.
Her family immediately started like pushing out photos of her everywhere on Facebook and social media. And then so on December 22nd in a press conference, Joe's boyfriend Greg said, "I desperately want her back. I thought we would be together forever." I think the wording "I thought we would be together forever" is kind of weird. Like, what are you assuming?
Oh, because you're saying that it kind of suggests that he's assuming that she's gone forever.
Yeah. It's kind of weird, but I digress.
I definitely think that's something to look into, at least.
Yeah. So, and then on December 23rd, during a live broadcast by BBC News and Sky News, Joe's father said, "I think she was abducted after getting home to her flat. I have no idea the circumstances of the abduction because of what was left behind. She was taken somewhere." And I think that is just parental intuition at its finest. Like, her dad just knew that something bad happened. At this point, they're getting closer and closer to Christmas, and her family still has no answers. There's been no trace of Joe anywhere. Detectives have no idea what happened to her or where she is. It seemed like she was just gone. And then, sadly, on Christmas morning, a couple walking their dogs found Joe's body. She was found along Longwood Lane near a golf course and next to the entrance of a quarry in Fayland. This was only 3 miles from her home.
Oh, wow.
There were no visible injuries on her body, and police actually thought that she might have frozen to death. It was unusually cold, like below freezing for that part of England, and there was a ton of snowfall. I mean, this is just devastating. It's Christmas Day that they find your daughter's body. I don't think I would ever be able to handle it or be reminded of Christmas again. But
I just don't understand how she walks 3 miles away with nothing. So I don't really buy that. I mean, it's possible that she froze to death, but she must have been taken there.
Exactly. I completely agree. So the police took this shit seriously from the get-go, and the investigation was called Operation Braid and comprised 80 detectives and staff under Chief Inspector Phil Jones.
Wow.
Jones urged the public to come forward with any information to help catch the killer, especially potential witnesses who were in the vicinity of the apartment and Longwood Lane where her body was found. People were freaking the fuck out. Like, freaking out. This hit the British tabloids and created a frenzy. And British people love their tabloids. Like, and their tabloids.
Oh my gosh. The Sun?
Yeah. The Sun. Actually, The Sun comes up a lot in this case. So.
Yeah.
The police were advising civilians to secure their homes and warn women not to walk alone, especially at night. They received thousands of tips, examined over 100 hours of surveillance footage, 300 tons of trash seized from around Joe's apartment. The police did all of that within the first like few weeks of the investigation. They were on it for real. Crime Stoppers offered a £10,000 reward for any information leading to a conviction. As did The Sun. The Sun offered £50,000.
I'm kind of shocked that The Sun was offering that with how salacious their stuff usually is against women.
It's probably to get information on the case, like for them to sell more papers. Like, they have an ulterior motive in that. But so the police are looking at every lead. They also start to look at other unsolved cases with similar MOs. ones of particular interest were 25-year-old Melanie Hall, who disappeared in 1996 and whose body was discovered 13 years later in 2009.
Oh, wow.
And 35-year-old Claudia Lawrence, who went missing in 2009 and to this day has not been found. Wow. So very similar, like women.
This is all in a similar area as well? Yeah,
this is all in a similar area in England. So they eventually ruled these two cases out, but they do remain unsolved. So I think it's important to get their names out there if you're interested, Melanie Hall and Claudia Lawrence. So back to the timeline. She was last seen December 17th. She was reported missing on December 19th, and her body was found on December 25th.
Okay.
On December 28th, it was revealed that Jo had died from strangulation several days before her body was found. And the pizza was...
So did they not Okay.
I guess not. I guess the police couldn't see it when they originally found her body. The pizza was not in her stomach contents, just a weird fact.
Okay.
So no one knows what happened to that pizza. And there was also no evidence that Jo was sexually assaulted, which is a small blessing during this whole thing.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about Greg, her boyfriend. Kind of fishy that he didn't think anything was wrong when he hadn't talked to her over the weekend. And we all know the person most likely to kill a woman is her partner. Mm. So the police definitely...
Of course.
Yeah, right. So the police definitely start to look at him. They searched his laptop and phone, but they ended up ruling him out as a witness. Like, he was in Yorkshire the whole time. So, I mean, they end up ruling him out as a suspect, and they just decided to treat him as a witness. So Greg is kind of off the radar. Greg didn't do it. And the police end up getting a bunch of tips from the tip lines, and two actually turn out. A woman attending a party next door to Joe's apartment heard two loud screams right after 9 p.m. Joe was believed to arrive home around 8:45 or 8:50, so that would mean she was attacked almost immediately after returning home. This was corroborated by another neighbor who heard a woman scream, "Help me," that night. With these witnesses, the police are starting to think that maybe the person who did this had entered her apartment before Joe was home, even though there was no sign of forced entry. So this is where it starts to get really interesting. Joe and Greg's landlord actually lived in the same building. And guess who usually has...
because it's a house.
Yeah, and guess who usually has a key to your apartment so there's no forced entry? Your landlord. And the landlord knew that Joe was going to be home alone that weekend because he actually helped Greg fix his car before Greg left for Yorkshire. So the landlord could have had a key. I didn't find anywhere that he had a key, but your landlord has a key to your apartment.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, like they just do.
Or can also make another key because,
So he could have gotten inside completely undetected. That's why there was no forced entry. This landlord's name is Christopher Jeffries. At the time of the murder, Christopher Jeffries was 65 years old and a retired public school teacher. He was arrested for the crime on December 30th, just 5 days after Joe's body was discovered.
So the police must have had some decent evidence on him if they are arresting him.
Yeah, and I mean, the police are on it and they just really thought it was him. So now the British press fucking ran with this. Jeffries was a little eccentric, had really long, crazy white hair, and he was just a really easy target for the press. 2 days after Jeffries was arrested, he was released on bail. A few days after that, all charges were dropped after forensic searches of his possessions revealed that Joe was never in his apartment, Joe was never in his car. And his DNA was not in their apartment at all. And 2 days of interrogation, they just kind of realized it wasn't him, the police. But that it still ruined his life, what the press did. They called him a peeping Tom. They said he, like, because he was a public school teacher. They said that he was creepy to students and it completely ruined this guy's life. So, they dropped the charges, but you know, they can always bring them back. So he's like living in fear. The press is completely vilifying him. He has a trial by media. So between the time Jeffries was arrested and he was released, the police got a tip from one of Joe and Greg's neighbors. This neighbor's name is Vincent Tabak. Tabak, I don't really care. I hate him. So he was 32 years old at the time and actually lived in the apartment right next door to Greg and Joe with his girlfriend. Tabak is Dutch, and he was back home in the Netherlands for the new year when he contacted the police to tell them that Jeffries, the landlord, his car had been moved the night Joe went missing. So this is another reason that the police investigated Jeffries so hard, because they had a neighbor saying, oh, he sketchily moved his car that night.
Now, does he not usually move his car?
I mean, I guess, yeah. So he was basically trying to be like, oh, Jeffries, maybe this was out of character.
Okay.
So the police were like, wow, this is super crazy information. Like, we're going to fly an officer named Karen Thomas to Amsterdam to speak with you because you're in the Netherlands. So they want to talk to him away.
So did he call from the Netherlands?
Yeah, he saw it on the news. He saw Jeffries get arrested, and he called the British police because he's her neighbor. So he's Dutch. He's back home for the new year. He called the British police and say, oh, I'm her neighbor. I saw Jeffries, the person that got arrested, be suspicious this night. So they sent an officer.
So good on the police to send someone and do their due diligence to check this guy out in person.
Karen Thomas is a badass. So she goes to Amsterdam, to speak with him right away. I think it's like New Year's Eve or New Year's Day. Right away, Thomas, the detective, was suspicious of this guy, Tabak, because first of all, his story didn't match up with the story he gave police when they first interviewed him. They interviewed him three times after the disappearance before this fourth time. None of it matched up. And second, he was straight up asking about all the forensic work being done on the case in the most suspicious way possible. So this boss bitch, Karen, was like, you are super fucking sketchy, and I am reading through all of this right now.
Great.
She was on it. She was like, you are sketchy. You're lying to me. I interviewed you last time. So, okay. So I said that the police had interviewed Vincent Tabak, her neighbor, three times before. The first time was 4 hours after Greg reported Joe missing. They knocked on his door. Tabak denied knowing anything.
Okay, so all of these interviews were in person, though.
So, well, yes, a few. I'll tell you through all of them. So, the first one was, the police were so on it. 4 hours after Greg called, they were knocking on all the doors. So they knocked on Tabak's door, and he denied knowing anything or hearing anything suspicious to the police, and he just closed the door. That's all they talked to him about. Then, on December 23rd, the police searched his apartment. And Tabak joked with his friends that the police must have thought that he had stashed her in a drawer or something.
Excuse me?
Yeah, which is weird, and it's also disgusting once you know what happened. So
where do you get that?
And the third time was on Christmas Eve when our girl, Karen Thomas, the detective that flew to Amsterdam, called him just out of the blue to ask more questions. She was pushing this investigation. She asked more questions, and Tabak said he was alone all evening until the wee hours of the morning when he picked up his girlfriend from a party. So when Detective Thomas goes to Amsterdam to interview Tabak, first he changes his story about what he did that night. He says that, I went to two stores. I wasn't home the whole time. He changed his story, and she interviewed him a few days before that and was like, that you changed your story.
Right.
And then he is overly interested. That's what she said. Overly interested in the forensics of the case. And he even puts himself at the...
Both red flags.
And wait for the third one this dumbass does. He puts himself at the crime scene. He goes, well, maybe...
Strike three.
Right? Maybe I've been in their apartment before.
There you go.
I have set foot into their apartment.
Before
Joe disappeared, I think I was in her apartment, but it was when I was chatting.
Trying to excuse the DNA that they're going to find.
Exactly. And he goes, but I was chatting to Jeffries in her apartment. He's definitely just trying to explain why the DNA is going to be on the scene. And also, Joe and Greg had never seen Tabak before. So they moved in October.
Oh, okay.
He was actually on a business trip in America until like a week before the crime happened. So they had never run into him. They had never seen him.
Oh, wow.
And even though he was their next door neighbor. So why would his DNA be in their apartment if they had never seen you and they've been living there for 2 or 3 months at this point? It's just fucking weird. So he's trying to explain it.
Yeah.
Thomas is like fed up with this shit. And she's like, you're so sketchy and you're a liar, but I'm going to use this to my advantage. And she asks him for fingerprints and a DNA sample. And he seemed very concerned about and doing it, but he cooperated and he gave it to her.
Okay.
Thank God people are dumbasses. So after they cleared Jeffries, the landlord, Detective Thomas took her suspicions to the task force and was like, it is this guy, Vincent Tabak. I keep saying it different ways the whole time. But she's like, she's like, you guys, this is him. Like, he is a liar. So on January 20th, 2011, about a month after she was first reported missing, Vincent Tabak was arrested. What ended up putting the nail in the coffin was the DNA evidence. Not every source said this, but a few did, so I think it's true. They found his DNA on Joe's chest underneath her clothes. And I don't know what kind of DNA that is. I don't know. But her DNA...
They don't specify.
They don't specify, but her his DNA was found on her chest. So who is Vincent Tabak? He... And I'm not going to spend this much time on it, like you say. It's just not fucking worth it talking about these people, but... He's a Dutch engineer who lived and worked in the UK since 2007. He was the youngest of five children and described as an intelligent, introverted loner. Tabak moved into the apartment building with his girlfriend in June 2009. Joe and Greg moved in October 2010. And like I said, they had never met prior to Joe being murdered by him.
Right.
In the months leading up to the murder, Tabak had used his computer to research escort agencies during his business trips, and he contacted several sex workers by phone. He also viewed extremely violent internet pornography that depicted women being controlled by men, bound and gagged, and held by the neck and choked. One of the women he seemed to watch often bore a striking resemblance to Joe Yeats.
Wow.
So, I mean, do whatever you want. Like, I'm not going to shame you for having a kink or something, but don't fucking murder people. Like, get a sub that will do it with you. And, like, okay, so, but this guy's a fucking creep.
Well, it's also just a bit, it's kind of too much of, like, a coincidence, though, that she looks so much like that girl.
And when they found her body.
It's like almost that he was searching out someone that,
she had a pink t-shirt on, and it was pulled up in a way of, like, this one image that he looked at a lot. Of, like, this girl.
Oh, wow.
So, this guy's a fucking loser creep, but he kind of... So, at first, he's saying, you guys are framing me. That wasn't my DNA. This is a terrible DNA lab. And then everyone's like, shut up, dude. We know you did it. And he kind of realizes he's stuck in a hard place. So, he confesses to the prison chaplain. The chaplain decided that this was not a religious confession, so he fucking told everyone that he confessed.
Oh my god, go chaplain! Right?
So dope, so...
Go chaplain!
So then Vincent Tabak is like, oh fuck, I confessed to this. I'm gonna plead... He's like, I'm gonna plead guilty. I'm gonna plead guilty to manslaughter.
Good.
And the police and the prosecutors are like...
Is it a plea deal?
No, no, he's just said, I'm gonna plead guilty to manslaughter. And the prosecutors are like,
okay, that's not funny. How it works, dude. You don't get to choose your own charge.
Exactly. The prosecutor said, that's funny. We're not trying you for manslaughter. We're trying you for murder.
Right.
And manslaughter would mean that you didn't have any intent to kill them. It just kind of happened. Murder, there is intent. So now we get to the trial. The trial started on October 4th, 2011, 10 months after Joe disappeared. The prosecution argued that Tabak strangled Joe at her apartment within minutes of her arriving home. Tabak was a foot taller than Joe, and prosecutors said he used his height and build to overpower her. He then pinned her to the floor by her wrists. Joe fought hard. She suffered 43 separate injuries to her head, neck, torso, and arms during the struggle.
Oh my god.
The injuries included cuts, bruises, and a broken nose.
Oh my gosh.
So I also it's like so sad, but she fought like hell. She fought so hard. And
yeah.
This piece of shit said, Tabak said that the killings were not sexually motivated and told the court that he had killed Joe while trying to silence her after she screamed when he kissed her. He claimed that Joe invited him into her apartment and was flirting with him. So he kissed her. And then she started screaming.
Yeah, right.
Right? This guy also, I'll show you a picture of him. I'm sorry, no one would fucking flirt with this ugly motherfucker. This fucking disgusting dude. So
also, it's like if she's in a committed relationship, taking her boyfriend to Christmas to meet her family, like,
beautiful. It's so, and her boyfriend was like hot. Like, no.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, he's just trying to make it seem like it was her fault.
Which is disgusting. Again, he holds all of the secrets on what happened this night, and he never tells anyone.
Right.
So, this is his story. He never takes away this story. This is what he says.
Right.
He said that when Joe started screaming, he held his hands over her mouth and around her neck to get her to stop for 20 seconds with minimal force. Then how did she die? Because 20 seconds with minimal force... So I just choked myself, but
it's just like unbelievable. I mean, I don't know. It's not even unbelievable, but
no, the story is completely unbelievable. It's like, what? Who do you think believes you? But
it's like, it's just, I guess, upsetting and unbelievable that even when you're so caught and they have all this evidence against you and you already decide you're going to plead guilty, that you would still make up these lies.
Oh, and this motherfucker goes to jail. So just tell. You're never getting out. Just say just what tell. Happened just for tell. Their family. So, but this guy's a fucking coward. Right. We know that already. So, okay.
Right.
She and also minimal force. She has 43 injuries, including a broken nose.
Please.
Like, okay, then maybe what happened to her body?
For him, if he's bigger.
It's right. Just disgusting. So he then put her body in the trunk of his car, drove to Asda, which I think is like another supermarket, where he was filmed on CCTV buying beer, chips, and salt. Just living his life after he took this amazing woman's life away from her and she's in the trunk of his car. And he texted his girlfriend while he was at the store, "I'm bored."
No.
Yep.
No.
Yeah, I'm bored.
Oh my god.
Literally disgusting. So
Piece of shit.
He is the worst kind of human. He then drove her body.
Ew, I just looked up a picture of him.
He is disgusting.
He looks so scary. Why is his eye so small?
I know. He's the worst. We'll put his picture on Instagram. So
ew, I'm like throwing up.
Isn't that disgusting? So he then, imagine that's the last person you see. God, motherfucker.
Oh my god.
He then drove her body to Longwood Lane, where he attempted to drop her body into the quarry. The little asshole wasn't strong enough, so he just left her body on the ground. There was like a 4-foot wall.
Oh my god.
That then led over to the quarry, and if she had been thrown over that wall, the police think they probably never would have found her body.
Whatever. God.
So he was in, there was like blood stains on the walls. So you could tell that he tried to get her body over there, but he couldn't, which thank God he couldn't because they found her family can put her to rest and it gets solved. But,
the
jury deliberated for 2 days.
And also the evidence, the DNA evidence.
Exactly. That caught him. Exactly. So the jury deliberated for 2 days and delivered its verdict on October 28th, 2011. Vincent Tabak was found guilty of Joanna Yeats' murder by a 10-2 majority verdict. I guess in England, you don't have to have unanimous. It just needs to be majority.
Okay.
He is in prison for life with a minimum term of 20 years. The judge called Tabak very dangerous, thoroughly deceitful, dishonest, and manipulative, and that the murder was a dreadful, evil act. And just to put the nail in this coffin for this disgusting motherfucker, a few years after the trial, the police went through his computer again and found hundreds of images of violent child pornography.
Oh my god.
He was sentenced to an extra...
Can he get charged for that? And okay.
But it's only an extra 10 months in prison concurrently with his life sentence.
What?
For hundreds of images. It's like, okay.
You're 10 months. I mean,
fucking disgusting.
Yes, the U.S. judicial system can be fucked up, but in some way, I am very happy with this how guy harsh would be getting the U.S. sentencing is.
Also, this guy would be getting the shit beat out of him in prison if in the U.S. I don't know if the U.K. is the same sort of shit, but okay. Her parents.
In a way, I hope so. I mean, I don't wish violence upon
I wish anyone, violence upon this motherfucker is the worst. So
on this guy? Yeah.
David and Teresa Yeats did not attend court on the day of the verdict. They had gone to every other day of the trial, but they were just, the anticipation and the anxiety was too high, so they didn't want to go the day the verdict was released. But they did release this statement. We attended the trial of Joe's murderer not to see justice handed out to him, but to find out as much as we could about what really happened from the time Joe disappeared to when Joe's murderer was arrested. We never considered this trial as a process of justice for Joe. The last 4 weeks have been more stressful and intense than we ever imagined. Although we've been made aware of the nature of much of the evidence against Joe's killer, some of the details which came out were a surprise. There was never any doubt in our minds that Joe had been murdered and that we fully expected him to lie when he went into the witness box. We came here with little hope or expectation of hearing what happened on December 17th, but needed to see him and to hear what he had to say firsthand. We saw no emotion or remorse or regret for what he did to Joe. We felt all emotion expressed by him was false. All we heard were words of self-pity. For us, it is with regret that capital punishment is not a possible option for his sentence. The best we can hope for him is that he spends the rest of his life incarcerated, where his life is a living hell, being the recipient of all evils, deprivations, and degradations that his situation can provide.
Wow.
For ourselves, this trial has had little effect on our lives. We still lost our daughter, and our son has lost his sister. Our main sorrow is that Jo was not allowed to start her own family, have children, and achieve her potential. We will never get over our loss, how she was murdered, and the total lack of respect with which her body was treated. We still miss hearing her happy voice and seeing her living life to the fullest. And they go on in the statement to talk about the letters and cards they've received from the community, and they thank the investigators and anyone involved with the case because it was closed very quickly. So that's obviously really sad.
Right.
But I think they're right. Like, that guy should rot and have the worst things happen to him in prison, you know?
Absolutely. What was his sentence again?
It was life.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
And in the UK, I mean, that's a big deal in the UK because the sentences are...
Like, I wish he got fucking murdered by the state.
Right,
punishment should be here.
No.
So, yeah, like in the US, if he was in Texas, he would be definitely 100%.
I was just looking at the statistics, actually. So Texas in 2020 executed like 500, and the second most was 100 in like Arkansas.
Oh yeah, and Arkansas is fucking would kill people too, but Texas is yeehaw, motherfucker.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it was just a crazy year
conversation,
though.
Like, if it's death is okay, but in this situation, it's like,
I mean,
totally fine.
Coming from the parents, I can totally understand their point of view.
Yeah. And then going back to Christopher Jeffries, who was the landlord who got totally caught up in like the media and his name like tarnished.
Right.
He actually sued 8 different publications for damages for libel, and he won.
Great.
So
good.
They painted him as like a predator, peeping Tom, a creeper on his students, et cetera, et cetera. And it really ruined his life.
Yeah.
And that was good for him that he could win.
Yeah, because, I mean, now in this day and age with the media, once your name is out there and connected to some sort of bad thing, like murder or sexual assault or anything, you will never, ever
live it down. Exactly. It's like so. But he actually, a miniseries was actually made about Jeffries and his arrest, and it's called The Lost Honor of Christopher Jeffries. And it actually won some, like, British awards. Yeah, it was like, I think, best miniseries of the year for a British award.
Oh, wow.
And then also Greg Rudin, Joe's boyfriend, started a charity in Yeats' memory to raise funds on behalf of families of missing people. I don't know if it's still running. I couldn't find it. But if it is, someone should tell us. And then her family and friends planted a memorial garden at Sir Harold Hillier Gardens in Romsey, where Joe had worked as a student. Just a positive note on the end of that. So that is the tragic death of Joe Yeats and her story.
Wow, good job. I'm so glad that her family ended up getting justice and that the police were
so efficient and so on it from the very beginning.
Right. It's like, so it's not very common that they're so on it. I don't know if English police are better. I know Scotland Yard is pretty good, but I don't think they were on
this. I think that's like the FBI version. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. But I know that they're pretty legit.
Right.
So that was Murder Show. I hope everyone enjoyed the story this week. You can find us on Instagram at
Murder Show Pod. Or is it Murder Show Podcast?
No, it's at Murder Show Pod now.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Okay. And then our website is, oh, did you see the website I made it? It looks
good. Yes, but what is it?
It's not up yet, but if website, we don't have the URL yet, so let's not do that. We'll have a website soon.
We're working on a website of having it live. We have a Patreon.
What? Oh, yeah, the Patreon is patreon.com/murdershow. Okay, and then our email is
murdershowpod@gmail.com.
And you can just email us with any suggestions, anything we maybe said incorrectly, any corrections, all that stuff. So thank you so much. I'm so glad you listened.
Woo-hoo. Thank you so much. And see you next week.
Yes. Okay. Bye-bye.